Hello, I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's time for our birthdays. Roberto Rodriguez of Ankeny, happy birthday to you, Roberto. Bessie Williams of Fort Dodge, happy birthday to Bessie. Kyle Peterson of Iowa City, happy birthday to you, Kyle. And finally, Mary Jean Byrne of Cedar Rapids. Happy birthday to you, Mary Jean. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. Tammy Abdullah writing for the USA Today. After swift justice, what comes next? Unique circumstances of Floyd's killing make precedent difficult. In sentencing Derek Chauvin to 22 and a half years in prison, the criminal justice system showed it can act swiftly and severely when faced with a police officer's slow-motion murder of a black man recorded by bystanders and witnesses witnessed by millions. The question is whether the example made of Chauvin will change anything for the many black men and people of color who are disproportionately killed by police, often in an instant and inconclusive video and no witnesses. In Chauvin's case, the public saw a rarity as the levers of the justice system seemed to move decisively. Indictment, conviction, a stiff sentence, a historic civil settlement, plus upcoming trials on federal civil rights charges and unrelated charges of tax evasion. The state and federal governments are conducting civil rights investigations into the Minneapolis Police Department for an alleged history of systemic abuses. Chauvin murdered George Floyd, age 46, in May of 2020 after officers responded to a report that he had used a counterfeit $20 bill. Floyd was handcuffed, face down on the street, and repeatedly yelled, "I can't breathe," as Chauvin pressed a knee to his neck for more than 9 minutes. The egregious nature of Chauvin's crime led officers across the country and in his own department to disavow him and even testify against him. Chauvin, age 45, has sat in a maximum security prison since the jury convicted him on April 20th of second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter. At Friday's sentencing hearing, Chauvin offered his condolences to the Floyd family, but did not apologize for his actions. He said he was unable to speak further, citing other litigation. Under Minnesota law, Chauvin will serve two-thirds of his sentence, or 15 years, behind bars, and the remainder under supervised release similar to parole. Chauvin will get credit for the time he's already served. If you want to talk real plainly, white America can keep kicking Derek Chauvin, and that's great and that's fine, said St. Paul criminal and civil litigator A.L. Brown. But at the end of the day, you aren't going to get a whole lot more out of him than what has been placed on him. He is seeing a tremendous amount of accountability. The real question is, can we reproduce it in a way that prevents the creation of the next Derek Chauvin, who is out there wearing a badge, carrying a gun, who's in training, who's thinking about a career in law enforcement, who's gotten away with abuses unchecked, Brown said. That's the real task. I'm over Derek Chauvin. Holding Chauvin accountable. Chauvin's case was Minnesota's first state case court trial to be televised in its entirety, primarily because of pandemic safety restrictions. The jury's guilty verdict was the first time a white police officer was held accountable for murdering a black man in Minnesota. Terrence Floyd, George Floyd's brother, said he wanted to know from Chauvin, who sat several feet away, why? What were you thinking? What was going through your head when you had your knee on my brother's neck, when you knew he posed no threat anymore, yet he was handcuffed? Why at least didn't you get up? Why did you stay there? Terrence asked the court for the maximum penalty. We don't want to see no more slaps on the wrist, he said, because if it was us, if the rules were reversed, there would be no case. It'd be open and shut. We'd be in the jail for murdering somebody. So we asked for that same penalty for Derek Chauvin. Chauvin showed a callous disregard for human life and did so in front of children who will have to live with the trauma of that experience, said Nakima Levy Armstrong, a civil rights attorney and former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP. She noted that the alleged crime of providing a counterfeit $20 bill would not have even resulted in jail time. It is vitally important that Chauvin be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law, Levy said. As important as it is to hold Chauvin accountable, legal observers said the unique nature of the case makes it difficult for it to set any real precedent. Winston Smith Jr., another black man in Minneapolis, was fatally shot this month by sheriff's deputies on a U.S. Marshals task force who claimed he displayed a handgun. Though a witness statement contradicted them, there was no body cam footage. Chauvin's case was unusual, said Mary Moriarty, former chief public defender for Hennepin County, who noted that it was not only tried by the Minnesota Attorney General's office with more than a dozen lawyers working pro bono and some of the best expert witnesses I've ever seen, but Chauvin's actions were captured on cell phone and body cam video. This is atypical of the cases that usually involve an interaction between a police officer and a black person, she said. Those often involve gunshots, and the officer would say he or she was afraid and making a split-second decision using language found in constitutional law and precedent that has overwhelmingly been favorable to cops. The case does serve as a high-profile signal that law enforcement has been put on notice, that if someone dies, the days of sweeping the death and the reputation of the deceased under the rug are over, Brown said. Legal observers noted how unusual it is for a federal indictment to come down after a state conviction. That may be in part to ensure Chauvin serves out sentences concurrently and perhaps agrees as part of a plea deal to not appeal his state case, Moriarty said. The state case against the three other former officers, Thomas Lane, J. Alexander Kyung, and To Tao, are scheduled to go to trial next year. They have also been federally indicted, legal observers noted, probably in an effort to place pressure on them for a plea deal and to avoid further trial that may traumatize the already traumatized witnesses. The other three officers have been charged with aiding and abetting and aggregating factors. They could face sentences similar to Chauvin's if they are convicted in state court. Pro-police prosecution. During Chauvin's trial, the prosecution repeatedly called itself pro-police, aiming to show a clear distinction between Chauvin and the rest of law enforcement. The defendant is not on trial for being a police officer. He's not on trial for who he was. He's on trial for what he did, Prosecutor Steve Schleicher told jurors. Even Friday at Chauvin's sentencing hearing, Prosecutor Matthew Frank first thanked Minneapolis police officers for sticking to their oath and speaking honestly about their jobs and training during the trial. Being a police officer is a difficult job. We ask a lot of them, and most police officers do it right, Frank told the court. Then he reiterated, this case wasn't about police officers. It was about Derek Chauvin disregarding all that training he received and assaulting Mr. Floyd until he suffocated to death. In a way, the case provides a blueprint for how to prosecute such cases, Moriarty said. The strategy allows the prosecution to avoid alienating jurors who are traditionally supportive of police. Brown said it was wholly unnecessary for the prosecution to say they were pro-police. Who the hell is anti-police? It's a silly notion. The notion that we have to say we're pro-police or anti-police based on how the police treat us, Brown said. Any person would take offense to abuse. The problem with the pro-police tactics, said Sarah Davis, executive director of the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis, is that the prosecution is holding Chauvin accountable, relieved the rest of the criminal justice system of accountability. I have a lot of worry about the way that this allows law enforcement and police officers to say, that's not me, that's not us, Davis said. Davis said she's not sure it's possible to hold an individual officer accountable and also hold the system accountable for creating such an officer. There's a fundamental tension there, Davis said. In order to hold an individual police officer accountable, you have to demonstrate they're doing something outside of what the system allows. So the question then is, what does accountability look like for the system in this space? Moriarty said that although the Attorney General's office could have taken on the system, that wasn't the best strategic choice if the goal was to convict Chauvin. A lot of people were upset about going with the bad apple approach, Moriarty said, but the reality is the criminal legal system is not designed to change that system. For actual systemic change, Moriarty said, it's important to look to police, but also prosecutors, judges, and policymakers, because this can't be about a criminal trial. It has to be about how the system inherently functions. For example, prosecutors noting potentially problematic body cam behavior to supervisors when a case is presented by an officer, rather than merely declining to file charges because the officer has a credibility problem. Chauvin was indicted in federal court for allegedly violating the rights of a 14-year-old boy by detaining him without justification in 2017 and placing his knee on the boy's neck for 17 minutes, causing the teen to pass out. You ask yourself, what if there was some interruption in the way Chauvin behaved a long time ago, Moriarty said. If a prosecutor reviewed the video and said, you know what, you're a little out of control here. There was no need for you to do what you did. And if they told the police department, then could this have been prevented? The Legal Rights Center is working with other organizations to review dozens of cases Chauvin was involved in for potential misconduct or other issues, said Andrew Gordon, the center's deputy director for community legal services. Brown said Chauvin's successful prosecution gives white folks the room and space to say, well, what more do you want? You see, the system worked. Problematic jury instructions. To convict Chauvin, Hennepin County District Judge Peter Cahill allowed jury instructions that significantly and radically broadened the definition of assault, such that any unreasonable force constitutes assault, even if there was no intent to injure someone. If that person dies as a result, it constitutes felony murder, said Ted Samsel Jones, a professor at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in neighboring St. Paul. Those instructions are likely to become the precedent for jury instruction, Sample Jones said. In order to prosecute Chauvin, the state has pushed for this broad version of felony murder doctrine, yet which, yes, it is precedent and can be used against cops, but mostly it's used against black people and poor people, Samsel Jones said. Other than the state of Georgia, Minnesota has probably the most extreme felony murder doctrine in the country, Samsel Jones said, noting that this case is an incremental step towards solidifying bad law. That law allows anyone involved in a felony to be charged with murder if a death occurs during the course of the felony, whether or not the death was intended. Armstrong said she's not concerned about the broadening of the language. People of color are already subjected to harsher forms of criminal punishment for even lesser offenses than what we saw in this case, she said. Armstrong cited the case of Mohammed Noor, a black Minneapolis police officer who shot and killed Justine Ruchik when she approached his squad car in the dark. He was charged with second-degree intentional murder. Chauvin was charged with second-degree unintentional murder. Samsel Jones said he believes the Chauvin prosecution will go down as a mostly symbolic victory. He called it a possible setback for the prison population, which could grow even more if the expanded definitions of crimes and punishments are used to justify tough charges and long sentences. The win-at-all-cost mentality is understandable, given the stakes, but in the long run, it can have unintended consequences, Samsel Jones said. There's an old saying that hard cases make bad law, and it's also true that high-profile cases make bad law. Above all, he said, convicting one individual cop is no substitute for actual legal reform. The photo accompanying this article has a caption that reads, "People celebrate the sentencing of former police officer Derek Chauvin on Friday in downtown Minneapolis. Chauvin got 22 and a half years," and it shows a picture of a crowd. Most of the people visible happen to be women, and the kind of front and center young woman is wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt, and she's speaking into a bullhorn, and she is carrying a picture, a painting of George Floyd. Suzette Hackney, a national columnist for USA Today, writes, "Chauvin's lack of remorse, an insult to us all." Even while staring down the barrel of a potential 30-year prison sentence for murdering George Floyd, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin couldn't bring himself to say the two simple words to the Floyd family on Friday that might have suggested he had a glimmer of remorse. "I'm sorry." Instead, Chauvin offered his condolences before floating some bizarre assurance that the family would find enlightenment and tranquility down the road. There's going to be some other information in the future that would be of interest, and I hope things will give you some peace of mind, Chauvin said from a Hennepin County courtroom moments before he was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison. It was, we hope, the final insult from a man who has, from the moment Floyd encountered him last Memorial Day and the world witnessed his actions via video, leaned in, literally, to his contemptible behavior. Floyd died under the crush of Chauvin's body on May 25th of 2020. Floyd said, "I can't breathe," at least 27 times as Chauvin pushed his left knee onto Floyd's neck. He repeatedly readjusted pressure and held it there for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Floyd cried for his mother and cried for his life. Chauvin smirked as he listened to Floyd's pleas and those from onlookers, but he never let up. Particular cruelty, selfless man. Chauvin, 45, was convicted April 20th of second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter. Prosecutors had requested a 30-year sentence, while defense attorney Eric Nelson sought probation for his client. Last month, Hennepin County District Judge Peter Cahill agreed that Chauvin should face a higher sentence because of his crimes involving abuse of his position of trust and authority while killing Floyd in the presence of children. Cahill found Chauvin treated Floyd with particular cruelty because of the prolonged nature of the asphyxiation. Chauvin appeared to have little public support during the 3-week trial that led to his conviction. Rarely did anyone appear in a chair reserved for a family member or friend who wanted to be inside the courtroom, which had limited access because of COVID-19 restrictions. Chauvin's mother, Carolyn Pawlenty, spoke during sentencing proceedings Friday, insisting that she wanted America to know she supports her son. She characterized him as a quiet, thoughtful, honorable, and selfless man. She asked Cahill for leniency. "When you sentence my son, you will also be sentencing me," she said. "I will not be able to see Derek, talk to him on the phone, or give him our special hug. Accountability? Yes. Justice? No. I would like to note that Chauvin stripped Floyd's loved ones of all those familial niceties too, and much worse. Floyd is dead. I can't help but assert that the apple didn't fall far from the tree. Not once did Pawlenty address the Floyds or express any sorrow for their loss. Not once did she display empathy. Not once did she seem embarrassed or contrite for her son's actions. Chauvin will be held accountable. It started with the conviction and it ended Friday with a lengthy prison sentence. I won't quibble about Cahill's decision. He went above sentencing guidelines. Derek Chauvin will have years to think about his laundry list of uncaring actions during incarceration. Is it justice? No, of course not. Justice would mean that systems are in place to ensure that state-sanctioned murders can't be committed against any American. Today, we will embrace accountability. Tomorrow, we will begin work anew. Though Chauvin didn't have the heart or decency to offer Floyd family members a heartfelt apology for the loss of their father, brother, uncle, friend, I extend these words to them in his callous stead. I'm sorry. And to the tragedy in Florida, Trevor Hughes and Wendy Rhodes, writing for the USA Today, perilous search for 150 missing people, at least 9 confirmed dead in ruin of Florida condo tower. 9 people are confirmed dead and at least 150 remain missing as the painstaking and dangerous search for survivors from a condo building collapse continued Sunday in the seaside town north of Miami Beach. Accompanied by dogs trained to find people and bodies, searchers dug a 40-foot deep trench through the site to assist with their efforts, which were temporarily halted early Sunday when the rubble shifted. The trench provided access to new areas, Miami-Dade County authorities said. As a result of that, we were able to recover 4 additional bodies in the rubble, as well as additional human remains, County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava said at a morning news conference. Governor Ron DeSantis said research work is proceeding slowly, in part because the 136-unit building's rubble itself has forensic value and is being trucked to a warehouse for investigation into the cause of the collapse. They're looking for if there are voids where they could potentially rescue somebody. That's kind of the name of the game, DeSantis said. Obviously, you're going to start to see a lot of major debris that's going to be moved out of there. During the news conference, officials thanked other agencies and the federal government for offering assistance. Authorities said they have enough staff to maximize search efforts, taking safety into account. They said sending too many searchers into the area could risk hurting any survivors or other rescue workers by causing collapses. Neighboring Miami Beach declared a state of emergency Sunday, smoothing the way for additional state and federal assistance. President Joe Biden declared the collapse a disaster, a necessary step for helping secure federal assistance, aid, and reimbursements. Family members, many upset at the slow rate of recovery, were given a private tour of the area Sunday afternoon. Journalists were kept away during the visit to the site, where a crane had been lifting away large pieces of debris. A team of Israeli search and rescue specialists joined efforts to find survivors and recover bodies. Members of the team from Israel's Homefront Command are experts in engineering. They marched onto the site Sunday morning to join the search at the 12-story beachfront building where air conditioners and furniture still occasionally fall. Authorities DNA tested relatives to help identify bodies. Many of those who were in the partially collapsed Champlain building south were Jewish, and as many as 20 of the missing Friday are of that faith, Israel's general consul in Miami told the USA Today. Steve Asseltine, a Colorado-based urban search and rescue expert, said such searches are painstakingly slow because there's so much danger. Not only are you breaching and cutting as you go, but you have to shore up what's left, and you're trying to work in tiny little crevices, said Asseltine, a leader with Colorado Task Force 1, one of 28 urban search and rescue teams recognized by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Anything that was in the building is still there, but it's been pulverized. It's been damaged. That includes food, chemicals, wires. Anything that you think of being in your house becomes a hazard for rescuers. A wing of the residential building collapsed around 1:30 a.m. Thursday. Video footage captured the rapid disintegration of the building's center and wing in a cloud of dust. Since then, fires and floods have hampered search and rescue efforts, and authorities have proceeded cautiously using lasers to measure debris shifts. You have the fires that have been happening. Ultimately, that creates expansion in the metal, expansion in the concrete. It creates smoke. But those also take a chance of weakening an already compromised building, said Jimmy Petronas, Florida's fire marshal. Researchers are trying to work just as fast as they can, at the same time looking out for the safety and well-being of those doing the job to save the lives of others. It's a real delicate balancing act. Petronas said search and rescue teams from across Florida and from Mexico joined the effort. Crews worked 12-hour shifts in high temperatures and occasional downpours. Those crews are working 24/7 because they know that if anyone is potentially alive, there's a limited time span to find them, Asseltine said. Those crews are in there risking a lot to save a lot, and they're doing everything they can to help those families and the people who are potentially still trapped in that building. The public is kept far away from the site where dust fills the air in between rainstorms. Eric DeMora, who lived in the building for 3 years, said a late-night swim probably saved his life. DeMora said he visited his girlfriend earlier in the day and jumped in the ocean. She persuaded him to come inside and dry off, and the two fell asleep shortly before the collapse. He woke and began receiving frantic messages from friends who recognized the building from his social media posts. Among those killed in the disaster were Antonio Lozano, age 83, and Gladys Lozano, 79, who were about to celebrate their 59th wedding anniversary. The couple had dinner with their son, Sergio Lozano, a few hours before the collapse, he told Miami's WPLG-TV. If there's any solace in their deaths, he said, it's in knowing that the two went together and went quickly. The other fatalities identified are residents Manuel Lafont, age 54, and Stacy Fang, 54. Fang's teenage son, Handler, was rescued by Nicholas Balboa, who was walking his dog nearby and heard his screams. Elizabeth Weiss and Kyle Bagenstos writing for the USA Today. Inspection reports detailed concrete deterioration. Engineers noted design flaws and failing waterproofing that could lead to exponential damage about 990 days before much of the Champlain Tower South condominium complex collapsed. Documents released late Friday night show. The town of Surfside, Florida, released the documents, including an unverified 40-year inspection report that had been received 16 hours before or after the building's catastrophic failure. A letter to the Condominium Association's treasurer on October 8th of 2018 included pages of recommended repairs. One warned of failed waterproofing, causing major structural damage on a concrete slab over a garage, and said failure to replace the waterproofing in the near future will cause the extent of the concrete damage to expand exponentially. The author warned that the design was faulty, replacement would be complicated, and called it a systemic issue. Areas underneath planters and pools were mentioned in the report. The pool remained largely intact after the collapse. The problems outlined in that report could indicate that there were other unseen problems, said Greg Schlesinger, a Fort Lauderdale general contractor and attorney. It looks like inspectors may not have been able to examine structural elements in other parts of the building, Schlesinger said. There were probably similar water problems elsewhere. The damage outlined in that report indicates the problem is at the bottom of the building, said Mathis Levy, author of Why Buildings Fall Down, How Structures Fail. The wider issue is how long it took to begin addressing the report. The problem, obviously, is the report is 3 years old, and nothing was done until, well, you know, recently, Levy said. Surfside released additional documents and emails to the town website late Saturday afternoon. One email indicated the Condominium Association's then vice president sent the report that included information about the slab and the damaged concrete to a town building official as early as November 13th of 2018. The documents also indicate that repairs were estimated to reach at least $9 million. One resident told USA Today they recall discussions about costs running as high as $15 million. The reports released Friday and Saturday include detailed plans to permits for concrete repair and a courtesy notice reminding residents to turn off exterior lights so baby turtles wouldn't be confused when they hatched. The inspection report from October 8th of 2018 found abundant cracking and spalling of the columns, beams, and walls in the garage under the fallen tower. Spalling refers to the deterioration of concrete, sometimes causing flaking and the exposure of reinforcing steel bars known as rebar. Abundant cracking and spalling of varying degrees were observed in the concrete columns, beams, and walls of the ground floor parking garage, according to a structural field survey reported by Morbidus Consultants. It appears plans to correct these problems were not solidified until April of this year, despite the original report having been issued in October of 2018. Though some of this damage is minor, most of the concrete deterioration needs to be repaired in a timely fashion, the report noted. What caused the cracking isn't known, said John Wallace, a professor of structural engineering at the University of California, Los Angeles. It could be slow degradation over time. Maybe the concrete wasn't properly placed. It could be that the ground had moved somewhat, causing it, he said. Wallace cautioned that there is nothing to indicate this was the cause of the collapse. The report included photos of parking garage columns in which the concrete had cracked and rebar could be seen. A September 6, 2018 inspection report by Frank Morbido stated no bulging or settlement was observed. However, it noted that approximately 8% of the concrete slabs in the garage and building plaza had experienced concrete deterioration, and about 5% of the balcony structural floor slabs showed hairline cracking. The report found additional spalling in a small percentage of concrete columns and exterior walls. In another section of the report, it noted that the waterproofing membranes were beyond their useful life and needed to be replaced. It further noted that the pool and jacuzzi were leaking and needed to be removed and all cracking or spalling concrete repaired. It appears that the concrete framed slab that supports the plaza pool above the garage had undergone previous patching and crack repair. This work was performed less than satisfactorily and needs to be completed again, the report said. A document dated April 16, 2021 was titled 40-Year Building Repair and Restoration. It includes 84 pages of what appears to be bid specifications for repair to the building. The plans were completed by Morbido Consultants and stamped in red with "In Progress," set for 27-2021, not for construction. The bid documents also included plans for slab reinforcement and concrete and masonry repairs. It stipulated maximum load weights for the roof, floors, and plaza. A permit dated May 17th of 2021 for $1.1 million in roof maintenance included removing the existing roof system down to the concrete deck, priming the deck with asphalt primer, demolishing the existing stucco and insulation, and sealing, insulating and sealing the entire roof surface with hot coal tar pitch and embedded gravel. A permit from April 27th of 2021 showed that work worth $59,400 was being done to repair and refurbish roof vent fans, air conditioner disconnects, and other minor electrical work. Another permit dated May 5th of 2021 was for $169,473 for installation of roof safety anchors to facilitate window washing and for stucco repairs to the building exterior. Schlesinger and the contractor and attorney reviewed the original construction plans for the tower, which were also released Friday. He said they appeared to be a proper design that was typical of high-rise construction along the coast during the 1980s. But did the contractor build it, the tower, to the plans? Were the pilings that support the building anchored properly on the bedrock? He asked. Now let's turn to the opinion section from the Des Moines Register. Our first Your Turn guest columnist is Bruce Anderson, and he writes, Iowa is friendly to drivers and to electric vehicles. Iowa has a long, proud history of electric vehicles. The first workable electric vehicle in the country was invented here, making its debut in the 1890 CENIAMSED parade. And Iowa's automobile dealers have a long, proud history of selling and servicing Iowa's vehicles, regardless of the technology used to power them. That is why I was disappointed to read in the Register an opinion essay, a news story, making easily disprovable claims about Iowa dealerships and electric vehicles. Iowa's automobile dealers want to sell new vehicles. They want to help keep those vehicles operating safely. It doesn't matter whether they are powered by gasoline, flex fuel, diesel, natural gas, or electricity. Dealers want to sell whatever customers want to buy. With advancements in technology, what customers increasingly want to buy is electric vehicles. And when dealers sell the vehicles, consumers win. That's because intra-brand competition drives down prices. If someone shopping for a new truck can kick the tires on multiple lots, each dealer has to work harder to make the sale. That was the conclusion of the peer-reviewed study conducted by the Phoenix Center, and it's something dealers experience every day. The Iowa Motor Vehicle Franchise Act is also good for consumers. Iowa's franchise law is different from other states because it truly is a consumer protection law. The legislature was deliberate about that, and it's as true today as it was when it was enacted. Iowans rely on personal vehicles to get to work, get groceries, run errands, and most communities, no other options exist. Iowans need to have safe, reliable transportation, and that transportation frequently comes in the form of a personal automobile. But what happens when the car you rely on breaks down? Today, there's a network of franchise automobile dealers that are contractually and statutorily obligated to perform warranty repair work. That network, with highly trained technicians, spans the state in communities large and small. Even if the manufacturer goes out of business, the dealer must honor that warranty. When a vehicle is purchased online from the manufacturers, those protections are lost. The legislature saw wisdom in requiring repairs to be accessible to keep vehicles operating safely and make sure that someone relying on a vehicle can get it repaired. When the nearest service facility for a web-based manufacturer is a state away, warranty and recall repairs and other service work become much more complicated. And who will fight for you when the manufacturer of your vehicle decides the problem you're experiencing isn't a big deal? Dealers can and will advocate for their customers, their neighbors, and in disagreements with the factory. Dealers see their customers around town. They know them and will go to bat for them. Someone from Michigan or wherever the manufacturer is based, that isn't likely to do that. Iowans understand what Iowa needs. That's why the legislature created an additional registration fee for electric vehicles, not because they're playing favorites with fuel types, but because they know Iowa needs to fund its roads. Every vehicle on the road contributes to the wear and tear of our infrastructure. The gas tax paid at the pump goes directly to the road use tax fund and cannot be used for anything else. Electric vehicles use the roads too, in some cases putting more strain on the infrastructure because they weigh more. If the additional registration fee were eliminated, the state would need another way to cover the costs of road repairs. Everyone driving on Iowa's roads should pay for them. Dealers want to sell electric vehicles. They want to sell all vehicles. There may be reasons why Iowa isn't the top for electric vehicle adoption. Concerns about charging infrastructure and range anxiety may be factors, but blaming dealerships won't fix the problem. Groups wanting to encourage electric vehicle adoption, and Iowa's dealerships are leading the way, should focus on creating a robust charging infrastructure, educating consumers about the technology, and working together toward common goals instead of blaming the businesses and tax systems developed to protect and serve all Iowans. Bruce Anderson is the president of the Iowa Automobile Dealers Association. In letters to the editor today, Ambry Grund of Grimes writes, "Kids can deal with complex issues. I want my child to learn about racism, not the extreme dichotomy political strategists seem to want us to choose from. Either everything is perfect and racism doesn't exist, or everything is terrible and you should hate America. I want him to learn that racism can occur in legal and other political, social, and economic structures in ways that harm people of color. I want him to know racism is not just about individual bad people. Rather, racist ideas can consciously and unconsciously impact how we think about ourselves and others. I also want him to understand that people in this country experience life differently based on race, gender, and sexual orientation, and that he should be willing to listen. That is why it is so disappointing to see politicians like Kim Reynolds choose to parrot the political think tank language targeting critical race theory as part of the nationwide campaign to paint it or any concepts related to diversity or equity as hateful. I have confidence that my son will be able to hold on to two concepts at the same time and know that we have achieved tremendous things in our country and at the same time know we have tremendous racism that has shaped our country, our history, and our present. I have confidence that our country is strong enough to face the truth of systemic racism and to make changes that support the well-being and rights of all." From Mike Cloverdale of Nevada, "Coach Katie made me a better human. The recent Des Moines Register front page tribute to Coach Tom Katie was well deserved. Tom Katie was my homeroom teacher from 1968 to 1971 at Lincoln High School in Des Moines. Homeroom teachers do little more than take attendance and make announcements, but Coach Katie taught me how to be a better human being. I was elected Chief Justice of the student court my junior year. I recall only one case my court adjudicated, Wallace versus Katie. My buddy, Scott Wallace, wanted to join the school swim team coached by Katie. Coach Katie insisted the boys shave their heads, less drag in the water. Makes sense. But Scott was a long-haired who refused but made a counteroffer. He'd wear a swim cap. Problem solved. Katie refused his offer, hence their appearance in my court. We ruled unanimously in favor of Wallace. Here's the part where Katie taught me how to be a better human being. He was gracious in accepting our ruling. A successful coach is disciplined and gracious. He is both. Thanks for the lesson. Outside the pool, Coach Katie." And finally, from Sherry Hawk of Ankeny, "Solving the world, or saving the world, can provide jobs for millions. Have we succumbed to a new normal for our sick planet? Have we done that before when we faced the energy crisis of the 1970s and 80s? And decided to massively increase coal production to ease our dependence on petroleum. Back then, as now, the fossil fuel industry knowingly lied to us about the environmental consequences of mining and burning coal. That huge fabrication has cost us dearly, but we continue, our heads in the sand, to support the myths of clean coal and harmless fracking as our children and grandchildren suffer the very real effects of ignoring science and reality. We have a chance to avert the death of our planet. We can transform, heal, and renew by investing in a vibrant economy. Call on Congress to support the Thrive Act, a new transformational bill for a just economic recovery that would create 15 million union jobs to take on the climate crisis. The political cartoon today is drawn by Dan Shinneman for the Tribune Content Agency, and the title is, "Our Apologies, We Never Would Have Called You an Essential Worker If We Thought You Wanted to Be Paid Like One." It's a group of people talking to an essential worker. It's a woman standing there with her hat and apron on. And the people talking to her, telling her this, represent the major fast food companies. There's a King there for Burger King. There's a Little Caesar Pizza. There's a clown for McDonald's. And Wendy's is there with the little girl with pigtails. And then Colonel Sanders is in the back of the line. And again, they're saying, "Our apologies. We never would have called you an essential worker if we thought you wanted to be paid like one." Columnist Leonard Pitts writes, "No mystery why conservatives find education dangerous. I owe a lot to Gary Mahoney. He was the campus conservative back in the middle 1970s when I was a student at the University of Southern California, and we went at it hammer and tongs a few times on the opinion pages of the Daily Trojan. I no longer recall the details of our disagreements, but what I do remember is realizing that he was good and that I had to up my game, tighten my reasoning, sharpen my logic, if I hoped to stay in the ring with him. He made me better in the same way college did itself. Nearly five decades later, I value those years less for any specific thing I learned in class than for the fact that I learned how to think. Not what to think, but how. That is, how to gather and evaluate information, how to analyze and extrapolate from it, how to defend my ideas in the scrum of intellectual conflict. That's a lesson students will be denied if Republicans like Ron DeSantis get their way. Last week, Florida's governor signed a bill requiring the state's public colleges and universities to survey students and faculty on their ideological beliefs. The aim, he claims, is to prevent schools from indoctrinating students. DeSantis has hinted that those failing to show intellectual diversity will face budget cuts. You may gauge the sincerity of his commitment to that diversity by the fact that this comes 2 weeks after he pushed to ban the teaching of critical race theory, an academic framework originated by legal scholars over 40 years ago. Like other states where similar restrictions are becoming law, Florida seeks not to further intellectual diversity, but to prevent it. Meaning, it aims to protect kids raised on mom and dad's steady diet of Fox News and Breitbart from the shock of having any ideas they've thereby imbibed or challenged in the outside world, which is hypocritical on its face. After all, conservatives once, not unreasonably, chided liberals for trying to bubble wrap students with trigger warnings and safe spaces. Now they use force of law to do the very same thing. It should go without saying that it's none of the state's business what you or I think. It should be likewise obvious that this law will stifle debate and muzzle instructors, and thus antithetical to the mission of our colleges and universities. There's no mystery why conservatives find education dangerous. A 2015 Pew Research Center study quantified that the better educated one is, the more likely one is to hold liberal beliefs. But I'd argue, contrary to what conservatives seem to feel, that's not because of bullying professors shouting left-wing dogma. Rather, it's because once you learn how to think, you're less susceptible to thin reasoning and easy answers. And increasingly, that's all conservatism's got. That may not have been true, or at least may have been less true decades ago, but back then the right had some intellectual underpinning, had yet to devolve into the twitching id of perpetual resentment now on daily display. I mean, is anyone overawed by the profundity of Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene? Or how about Louis Gohmert or even Ron DeSantis? An opinion one can't defend using actual facts and recognizable reason is an opinion not worth having. At some level, conservatives must know they fail that standard, so they work to undermine it instead, to make the world safe for ignorance. Teach your children well, the songwriter said, but this is the opposite of that. I like to think Gary Mahoney would agree. Leonard Pitts Jr. is a columnist for the Miami Herald. And now looking at the USA opinion page, today's topic after Chauvin sentencing, our view, the hard work of ensuring racial justice remains. Gianna Floyd won't hug her father at her high school graduation. She won't dance with her dad at her wedding. She'll never be able one day to place her newborn baby into her father's arms. Derek Chauvin stole those moments from her as he stole the life of her father, George Floyd. The sentencing Friday of Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer, to 22 and a half years in prison for Floyd's murder has brought this tragic case to a welcome end. But it is only one marker in America's long, vital request for racial equality and justice. Breonna Taylor, Tamir Rice, Stephen Clark, Alton Steering, Walter Scott, Deontay Wright. In the 13 months since Chauvin pressed his knee to Floyd's neck, more than 9 minutes, the nation has been forced to confront the fact that racial injustice remains deeply rooted in the American experience. Cities have made progress in providing alternatives to policing and in making policing itself less dangerous and more effective for the public. The nation has even embraced a new federal holiday that acknowledges America's devastating history of enslavement and racial discrimination, one that also speaks of inspiration and hope. And yet, even as hard and necessary conversations and actions have taken place, police across the country killed 1,127 people last year, according to data collected by Mapping Police Violence. Nearly half of those killed, 48%, were Black and Latino people, even though combined the two groups make up only 30% of Americans. America clearly has many more mountains to climb in its struggle as a nation for true equality and justice. Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Philando Castile, Jonathan Price, Sincere Pierce, Angelo Quinto. The Chauvin case has ended with a just verdict and a fair sentence. The essential work of ensuring racial justice very much remains. Gianna Floyd is only 7 years old. Racism, injustice, and police brutality already have cost her more than anyone should have to sacrifice in a lifetime. In a heartrending victim impact statement Friday, Gianna said via video that if she could tell her father anything, it would be, "I miss you and I love you." Derek Chauvin stole from Gianna the chance to say those words in person to her father. For her, for the nearly 45 million Black Americans, indeed for all Americans, the nation must press harder and faster toward the day that this nation finally lives up to its ideals of liberty and justice for all. Other views: a public tragedy haunts America's public safety. Miriam Aronne Krinsky and Brendan Cox write, broader transformation requires shrinking the footprint of the criminal legal system and promoting deep investment in community health, infrastructure, and transparency. But effective and empowered civilian oversight of law enforcement is a vital first step toward developing a holistic shared vision of public safety, co-owned and co-created by the community, and will go further in repairing and addressing the harms wrought by police misconduct than any single case or sentence. Aaron Aubrey Kaplan writes, there was no protest following the sentencing. It's worth pausing to mark the muted reaction to this moment. The calm that's greeted the Chauvin sentencing stands in contrast to the explosion in the 1992 in the wake of the acquittal of all four Los Angeles officers who brutally beat Black motorist Rodney King, the first and most famous incident of police brutality to be captured on video. That verdict touched off historic days of civil unrest in LA, not really because it surprised Black people, but because it infuriated them. George Floyd immediately achieved a symbolism and a kind of heroism that Rodney King did not. Floyd was not just another Black victim of police misconduct. He was a tragedy that belonged to all of us. This shift in perspective was simple but radical, exactly the kind of change Martin Luther King Jr. stumped for his whole life, but understood was elusive, a change of heart. And James D. Zirin writes, according to data amassed by Ohio criminologist Philip M. Stenton, Chauvin joins the list of 8 officers convicted of murdering someone on duty since 2005, with sentences ranging from 6 years to life. I wish I could conclude that these figures tell us that such horrific acts as Chauvin's are few and far between. Unfortunately, they tell us that police brutality is not prosecuted in the same way as other murders. Prosecutors, judges, and juries have historically given the police the benefit of the doubt. And finally, from Elliot Williams of CNN, no criminal trial can absolve an entire nation's sins around race. Jason Sattler, from the Board of Contributors to USA Today, writes, "Fight for $15 drive is transformational. Workers expect more, and that's a good thing. What do you call a worker shortage that turns into a flood of applications when an employer offers higher pay? Sounds more like a wage shortage. Workers are waking up to the reality that America's labor force has more negotiating power now than it has had in years, if not generations, and some, if not most, of the credit has to go to Fight for $15, the most transformative labor movement of the 21st century. We see the success in the way workers aren't rushing back to low-paying jobs more than a year and a quarter after COVID-19 put our economy into a medical coma. Instead, they're considering new professions in a way they didn't dare to do during the Great Recession a decade ago. Republicans argue that overly generous support of unemployed Americans is making them too picky. That's why 22 GOP-led states have pulled the plug on those benefits, hoping to force them back into the job market. But don't expect this cruelty to work, especially when in-person school days and childcare services are still spotty, and working for dismal wages could mean risking your life, your family's lives, during a pandemic. Thanks to Fight for $15, workers have been taught to expect more. By more, I mean more than double the federal minimum wage, which last went up in 2009. Landlords won't let you pay rents that were set in 2009, so why should you accept a fraction of what your time is worth in 2021? Yes, it took us almost a decade to filled with record corporate profits and a once-in-the-century health crisis to get to this point, but it's time this simple yet infectious movement and the workers who fueled it get the credit and the wages they deserve for shifting the ground under employers' feet. Raises for $22 million. In 2012, after the Occupy movement spotlighted the crisis of income inequality and then flamed out, activists from Service Employees International Union and New York Communities for Change came up with the idea of mobilizing the nearly 4 million Americans who serve us Whoppers, Big Macs, and Crunchwrap Supremes, the movement's two demands, a union and a $15 minimum wage. The following year, 2013, marked a first time President Barack Obama mentioned the minimum wage in a State of the Union address, though he only proposed a raise to $9 an hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, called for a $15 minimum wage in 2015. His opponent for the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination, Hillary Clinton, followed suit with some conditions. Joe Biden took on the $15 pledge in 2020 and has raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour for federal contractors. Fight for $15 now claims success in winning wage increases for 22 million people across America, including 10 million on their way to $15 an hour. Delaware this month became the latest state in that category. And on Friday, Southwest Airlines announced that in order to attract and retain the best candidates for open positions, its new minimum pay will be $15 an hour. Wonder where it got that number? Perhaps the most ringing indicator of the movement's success is that the nation's three largest retailers, Amazon, Target, and Walmart, all now employ the $15 benchmark in some fashion. Amazon and Target start all employees at $15, and Walmart claims to be paying almost a third of its 1.5 million person workforce at least $15 an hour. Set ambitious goals. But the retail success story also points to the failure of Fight for $15's other demand, a union. Labor recently suffered a devastating loss trying to organize an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, and has made almost no inroads in organizing Target, Walmart, or any U.S. fast food chains. But expecting Fight for $15 to single-handedly restore the balance between labor and capital in America is a bit much to ask. McDonald's workers in Denmark earn nearly $22 an hour and get 6 weeks of paid vacation, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said in a viral tweet. This is true. Denmark has no minimum wage, but it does have sectorial bargaining that requires contracts to be negotiated across an entire business sector. In America, where only 6.3% of private sector employees are in a union, we have the opposite of sectoral bargaining. Secondary or solitary strikes are illegal, and the decline of labor membership has been accompanied by an increase in income inequality. Still, unions are as popular now as they have been any time since the late 1960s, and the clarity of Fight for $15 seems to help workers recognize the value of their toil. But we'll need a lot more power and union members to get anything that even resembles Denmark. How to build on the rousing success of Fight for $15? I'd suggest an even more audacious demand, a 30 by 30 campaign calling for a $30 minimum wage and 30% of the private sector to be unionized by 2030. It sounds impossible now, but we've already seen some of the impossible become possible. The lesson of Fight for $15 is to be clear and aim higher. And in America, who can argue with success? Jason Sattler, aka at LOLGOP, is a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors and host of the GOTMFV show podcast. Dave Granlund draws the editorial cartoon on the USA Today page, and it shows a man dressed in overalls with a hard hat on his head and the title Inspector on his name tag. And he says, "Florida condo collapse? Who knew?" And in his hands is a list of things that he has checked off. Built on the swamp? Check. Building was sinking? Check. Cracks in the concrete? Check. Water damage? Check. One final quick news article here, written by Jesse Mendoza for the Palm Beach Post. Surfside condo memorial echoes memories of 9/11. Tearful families and sorrowful residents adorned a makeshift chain-link fence memorial over the weekend with photos, flowers, candles, toys, and notes for those missing after a portion of the Champlain Towers South condominium collapsed early Thursday morning. It echoed similar scenes from almost 20 years ago when people arrived by the droves to leave similar notes and mementos to those missing after the collapse of the World Trade Center in New York on 9/11. This memorial was in Miami Beach at the back of the property of the fallen tower. It's a clear vantage point on the partially collapsed building and the rescue efforts. Saturday morning, visitors paced on the avenue to visit the memorial and to catch a glimpse of the fallen building. People who said they had relatives missing declined to comment. Some embraced, others prayed, still others reached out and touched the faces on the photos they had just pinned. Onlookers watched crews methodically sift through rubble, searching for survivors. Gladys Perez lives one block away from the collapsed building. Thursday morning, she woke to flashing lights, leaving her disoriented. "I didn't feel it, but the lights woke me up," Perez said. "I saw crews pulling people out through their balconies. My husband has a great friend who's missing, and we don't know anything about them. They were on vacation here." Viviana Escanachi, tears in her eyes, walked down the road with her daughter and dog. She lived at the Champlain Towers for 6 years. She and her husband sold the condo in 2010 to a woman who is missing. Escanachi is worried about her and many others in the building. "Everyone is missing now, but we are not giving up hope that somebody could still be alive." And that's it for our second hour of The Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.